Mormon Sunday School is a production of the Olam Institute, which aims to nurture constructive approaches to religion and religious education. If you find this podcast helpful, please go to mormonsundayschool.org to sign up for a monthly subscription or to make a single donation. As the Olam Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit, all contributions are fully tax deductible. We also welcome you to join the conversation on Facebook or email me at jared@olaminstitute.org. Welcome back to Sunday School, everyone. I'm Jared Anderson, and this is Engaging Gospel Doctrine, episode 194, which covers lesson 21, Alma Did Judge Righteous Judgments. In this reading, we are wise to pay as much attention to what Mormon does not say as to what he does. The manual goal is to help class members understand righteous principles of government and avoid priestcraft and pride. The Engaging Gospel Doctrine goal is to help class members take into account their own biases and constructively engage with those who believe differently, and to encourage them to act as responsible citizens. Okay, after this, we have 3 episodes left. I want to start with a fundraising note. As I was working on this episode, I received a few canceled payment notifications. Not very encouraging as I work. Even though the 4 years is up, we aren't done. I will remain engaged and keep the podcast a helpful resource for Sunday school, and this podcast will continue to need your support. I will keep this podcast valuable as I add other exciting projects. And remember, if you are in a position to give a thank you donation for completing the 4-year cycle, I would appreciate that. That will be very important as I transition into new stages with the Olam Institute. Okay, let's go over the outline. First, the Sunday school portion. I will frame the reading, give the 2-minute take-home focusing on responsible citizenship, communicating across differences, and an example of close reading, Mormon as a biased narrator. I will then go through the reading commentary and give the lesson, which covers the following points. 1, how can we be aware of our biases? 2, how can we respect others who believe differently than we do? 3, how can we communicate effectively across ideological divides? 4, what was the Church of Nehor? Lessons from the 2 churches, being a responsible citizen, and then the hidden story of the Amalekites, who may be the same group as the Amalekites. And relatedly, we look at how hard Mosiah argues to get rid of kings, but his biases as well. So lots about understanding where we're coming from and using that as a way to connect to others. There will be no scripture study portion this episode, but we do have part 3, the study notes. I want to talk a little bit about humanism and religion, the question of why do people leave the church, how best to talk to those who have left the church, how can those who have left constructively talk to active members, and then the very challenging but timely question of whether there is an ideal form of government. Don't get your hopes up too much. That is not my area of expertise, but I will link to some resources. Let's get into the Sunday school portion. I have to admit that I thought these were going to be boring chapters, almost a throwaway lesson, but I was surprised by how much a close reading revealed. Just you wait. I mean, it's really interesting. 2-minute take home. First, responsible citizenship. These chapters talk about replacing kings with judges and get into systems of government. And that reminds us that we need to vote. As we know very clearly, it being late 2016 election year, we get so excited by presidential elections, but there's so much more going on, and actually more pertinent to our civic duties. we have to vote for and even get involved in local government. Okay, communicating across differences. We need to be aware of how we work, how others work, and how to bridge that. I suggest we focus on three levels: love, respect, understanding, and being influenced. Being open to another's influence is a powerful way to show love and respect and openness, treating someone else as a person worthy to be taken seriously. And I think that these steps progress one to another. Love, I mean, we just have to love everyone. That's a commandment. But respect builds on love. Not only do we love them, but we give them the benefit of the doubt. We trust that they are a good person. And then if we can, we seek to understand where they're coming from, put ourselves in their shoes, look beyond our own biases and perspectives, and be changed, be influenced by the other person. And then if you are able to, it's interesting to point out how Mormon is a biased narrator in these chapters. What does Mormon talk about? What doesn't he talk about? What does he emphasize? What does he brush over? And the story that emerges when you take into account the biased narrators in the section is quite interesting. So again, two-minute take-home, focusing on responsible citizenship, communicating across differences, the importance of love, respect, and understanding, three principles that build on each other, and then the idea of Mormon as a biased narrator. We will now move into the reading commentary, and you will see what a close reading reveals. The class member reading is Mosiah 29 and Alma 1 through 4. Most members of the church probably couldn't tell you what is in Mosiah 29 and Alma 1 through 4 without checking. It's a transitional section about the change in Nephite government and then Alma's decision to give up the position of chief judge and become a minister the rest of his life. Okay, Mosiah 29, verse 1. Now when Mosiah had done this, he sent out concerning all the land among all the people, desiring to know their will concerning who should be their king. Sounds really open and democratic, right? Why did he do this after all his sons rejected the monarchy? Were there other options? Was this a formality? Is he just setting up the people for his pitch for judges? It kind of feels like that's what he's doing because he is so anti-monarchy in this chapter. And we will see in the Alma chapters that people do put forward a candidate for king, and that does not go well. So the people say, hey, we want your son Aaron to be the king and the ruler. Verse 3, now Aaron had gone up to the land of Nephi. Therefore the king could not confer the kingdom upon him. Neither would Aaron take upon him the kingdom. Neither were any of the sons of Mosiah willing to take upon them their kingdom. They rejected the highest status and comfort possible in order to preach to their enemies. As Mormon emphasizes, truly their hearts had been transformed. This is a very inspiring story. And then Mosiah sends his message. You know, this is what he's going to try to convince the people to accept. He says, he to whom the kingdom doth rightfully belong has declined, you know, his eldest son Aaron. If there should be another appointed in his stead, I fear there would rise contentions among you. And who knoweth but what my son, to whom the kingdom doth belong, should turn to be angry and draw away a part of the people after him. This is interesting because even though Mosiah is rejecting the idea of kingship, he still presupposes that kingship is valid. The way that he talks about, oh yeah, and by the way, of course the kingdom belongs to my son. As Mosiah says explicitly in verse 9, he's concerned that his son will return to his wicked ways. And he says, okay, be wise, consider these things. We don't want to destroy my son. We don't want to destroy someone else. Let's be wise. Let's look forward to these things. In verse 10, looking forward and considering potential consequences is a good way to be wise. And then he makes his pitch in verse 11. Therefore, I will be your king the remainder of my days. Nevertheless, let us appoint judges to judge this people according to our law. And we will newly arrange the affairs of this people, for we will appoint wise men to be judges that will judge this people according to the commandments of God. This would result in something like a democratic theocracy, where leaders are voted for, or at least confirmed by the populace, but they follow God, and it's seen as God's laws. Verse 12, it's better to be judged of God than of man, but, you know, God is not available to judge us in this life. Verse 13, if it were possible for just men to be your kings, then that'd be great. It'd be great to always have kings if people were always just. Here Mosiah shows his humility. He holds up his father as a standard, not himself. Note that he embraces a theocracy. God judges perfectly, so men who pass on the judgments of God to the people are the ideal. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work out so well in practice. And he says, I myself have labored, I have worked to teach you the commandments, to establish peace, to punish people according to their crime. Verse 16, because all men are not just, it is not expedient that ye should have a king or kings rule over you. This is an interesting argument. He just said that his father and he have been just, and you could encourage the finding of just men rather than throwing out kingship. And if there are unrighteous kings, why couldn't there be unrighteous judges? 17, how much iniquity doth one wicked king cause to be committed, and what great destruction? Here, Mosiah is making an argument of risk avoidance. Because humans have a tendency to be wicked, and one wicked king can do a disproportionate amount of damage, better not to have a king. He brings up Noah as a really bad example. And not only was Noah a terrible king, but Noah led to vicious cycles, having friends in iniquity and keeping guards and establishing laws that protect the powerful. So we have vicious cycles and virtuous cycles that work on human nature. So again, he says kings are bad. He also adds that even if a king is righteous, that burdens one person unduly. Therefore, once again, verse 25, choose you by the voice of this people judges, that ye may be judged according to the laws which have been given you by our fathers, which are correct, and which were given them by the hand of the Lord. Again, theocracy. Verse 26, it is not common that the voice of the people desireth anything contrary to that which is right, but it is common for the lesser part of the people to desire that which is not right. Therefore, this ye shall observe to make, and make it your law, do your business by the voice of the people. This is a pretty sound argument for democracy. Unfortunately, it is common for the majority to care about issues that influence them and not to care about issues that impact the minority. He says, if the voice of the people doth choose iniquity, you know, the judgments of God are coming. This is definitely an appropriate time for a Trump joke. And then we have checks and balances. If the judge does not judge according to the law, they can be judged of a higher judge. If a higher judge goes off the rails, a group of lower judges should be gathered together, and they shall judge the higher judges. Verse 30. I command you to do these things in the fear of the Lord. I command you to do these things and that ye have no king. So he's moving from persuasion to commandment. Mosiah is really pushing this no king idea. And the Nephite versus Mulekite tension makes a great deal of sense of this. Note that much of the conflict in the book of Alma comes from people wanting to have a king. And I don't think we can just take Mormon's word as far as what really happened, because it seems that the Nephites were keeping power limited to them, and anyone who tries to have a king, they destroy. You know, along with justification for doing that. Verse 32, I desire that this inequality should no more be in this land, especially among my people. I desire that it should be a land of liberty. Every man may avoid his rights and privileges alike. One has to ask, you know, as nice as this rhetoric is, one has to ask what would happen if his sons had reformed but still been willing to be king. I think Mosiah would have been thrilled and not giving the speech. He would have been like, you know, fantastic. The righteous leaders are extending to another generation, and I'm so grateful that Aaron is righteous and wants to be a good king the way my father was. So he keeps going. He talks about the disadvantages they labor under by having an unrighteous king to rule over them. Remember, they've had righteous kings for multiple generations. Mosiah, Benjamin, Mosiah the First. We have reason to think that the earlier kings were righteous. Wicked kings seem to be an exception, but Mosiah is pushing this really hard. And then he says straight up, and by the way, we shouldn't have kings anyway. These are expressly repugnant to the commandments of God. Mosiah is pushing as hard as he can. He says there are problems with the righteous king because he's so burdened, and problems with the wicked king because then everyone else is burdened. Then he adds that God hates kings anyway. I mean, he makes it sound like that by emphasizing how awful a wicked king is and that God hates the wicked king's actions. Verses 37 and 38, it came to pass after King Mosiah had sent these things forth among the people, they were convinced of the truth of his words. They relinquished their desires for a king, became exceedingly anxious that every man should have an equal chance throughout all the land, and every man expressed a willingness to answer for his own sins. This certainly sounds great, and these are important principles, and this is a good form of government. But even so, it's productive to dig a bit deeper into Mosiah's motivations. So what happens? They cast in their voices concerning who should be the judges. They were exceedingly rejoiced because of the liberty which had been granted among them. Mormon gives an ode to Mosiah. They did wax strong in love toward Mosiah. They did esteem him more than any other man, for they did not look upon him as a tyrant who is seeking for gain, yea, for that lucre which doth corrupt the soul. For he had not exacted riches of them, neither had he delighted in the shedding of blood, but he had established peace in the land, and he had granted unto his people that they should be delivered from all manner of bondage. Therefore they did esteem him, yea, exceedingly beyond measure. Interesting juxtaposition. They were just convinced why kings are a bad idea, but have an increased devotion to their king. Likely because Mosiah is so humble, he realizes the risks of being a king. He compensates for them, including giving up the idea of kingship eventually. So he's like an unking or king light. It's rewarding to find the complexity in the scriptures. Mosiah was likely motivated by self-interest in pushing for judges. He would have supported his sons as king, but is now avoiding Amalekites pushing for a king from among their people. But even so, the outcomes are initially very positive. Mormon also seems to be strongly supporting this move as well. I agree that Mosiah and Alma both seem like fantastic human beings, but again, a theme of this reading, or a theme that I'm making, is we can still remain aware of bias in this narrative. Read it yourself. Doesn't it seem that Mormon has to work really, really hard to convince us that the Nephites were in the right? Verse 41, and it came to pass that they did appoint judges to rule over them or to judge them according to the law, and they did throughout all the land, local judges. Of course, kings have local administrators as well. Alma was appointed to be the first chief judge, he being also the high priest. Now, it's interesting that power ends up being concentrated in one man anyway. We went from having a king and a high priest to having one person who is both chief judge and chief priest. Verse 44, thus commenced the reign of the judges throughout all the land of Zarahemla among all the people who were called the Nephites, and Alma was the first and chief judge over the Amalekites as well, though they're not mentioned. Alma the elder died being 82, Mosiah died being 63. I wonder what Mosiah died from. 63 seems young for natural causes, so maybe of some disease. And thus ended the reigns of the kings over the people of Nephi, and thus ended the days of Alma, who is the founder of their church. Alma and Mosiah were both revered leaders. I love the way that we can get attached to characters in books. Mormon tells us about two main conflicts in the first chapters of Alma. First, Nehor, and then the battle with the Amalekites. In both of these instances, Mormon insists, almost protests, that yes, the Nephites are doing what's right. Yes, Nehor and the Amlicites absolutely deserved what was coming to them, what happened to them. But I really believe that Mormon is an unreliable narrator in these cases. And if we read closely, we see that the situation is more complicated. Look at Mormon's assumptions and presuppositions. Look at his rhetoric. Look at what he emphasizes and what he doesn't emphasize. Alma 1:1. Now it came to pass that in the first year of the reign of the judges over the people of Nephi, from this time forward, King Mosiah having gone the way of all the earth, having warred a good warfare, walking uprightly before God, leaving none to reign in his stead. So he's still kind of assuming the kingship paradigm. Nevertheless, he had established laws, and they were acknowledged by the people. Therefore, they were obligated to abide by the laws which he had made. So even though the judges are the ones overseeing things, it is still these kingly laws that govern things. So again, Mormon is speaking in terms of kingship even after Mosiah vehemently rejected the institution. In verse 2, we are introduced to Nehor, and it's interesting that we don't get his name for quite a while. He's large, he's noted for his much strength, and he goes among the people preaching to them that which he had termed to be the word of God. So this is interesting. He feels called by God. It says he bears down against the church. He declares to the people that every priest and teacher ought to become popular. They ought not to labor with their hands. They ought to be supported by the people. This sounds a lot like Noah and his priests. I don't know that we can trust Mormon's summary of Nehor's gospel. He testified that all mankind should be saved at the last day. Now, I think that's plausible. I think it's kind of ironic, since this is something that I personally like very much, but it seems that Nehor is preaching some combination of a Christian universalism and a religious humanism. I'll come back to that. He's lifted up in the pride of his heart. He's establishing a church after the manner of his preaching. It's worth noting that Nehor seems to fit better into 19th century America than antiquity. I've linked to a resource about that. But again, even if, you know, whatever Nehor was really teaching, it makes sense that it would be communicated in a way that Joseph Smith would have understood and that would have been pertinent for his 19th century American audience. Verse 7, and it came to pass as he was going to preach to those who believed on his word, he met a man who belonged to the church of God, yea, even one of their teachers, and he began to contend with him sharply that he might lead away the people of the church, but the man withstood him, admonishing him with the words of God. I'm not saying Nehor was a good guy, but again, we need to remember Mormon's biases. And this is the hero Gideon. And Nehor kills Gideon, and that is what ultimately brings Nehor before the people. And he pleads with Alma with much boldness. This Gideon-Nehor exchange very well could have been a duel. We're not sure what that is. Verse 12, Alma said unto him, behold, this is the first time that priestcraft has been introduced among this people, and behold, thou art not only guilty of priestcraft, but hast endeavored to enforce it by the sword, and were priestcraft to be enforced among this people, it would prove their entire destruction. This doesn't seem like an accurate summary of what happened. Nehor got upset and probably challenged Gideon to a duel, as I said, and he preaches his views through persuasion rather than violence. Alma seems to be painting Nehor as this terrible person. Now, verse 13, the fact that he shed the blood of the righteous man, that's valid. You know, that's a valid accusation, even though it could have been more a duel than Nehor just killing Gideon. This is a culture of honor, and so that would have been an acceptable way to engage. This is interesting. Alma condemns him to die, verse 15. it came to pass that they took him, and his name was Nehor. We don't even know his name until he's about to die. This could point to the fact that he was very popular, you know, that he had such status that Alma and or Mormon don't want to acknowledge how persuasive he is. They carried him to the top of Manti. He was caused, or rather did acknowledge between the heavens and the earth, that what he taught the people was contrary to the word of God, and there he suffered an ignominious death. I believe the first description. They forced him to recant, which he wouldn't have done on his own, and then executed him. This seems pretty heavy-handed. They are shutting down this movement by killing the leader and using the death of Gideon as a way to justify that. And again, you know, the death of Gideon was not a good thing, but I think it's more complicated than what the narrators are telling us. So in summary, Nehor was probably more successful than Mormon is admitting, and his message could have been more compelling and even more good than he is acknowledging. This narrative of blank tried to destroy the church, or this individual tried to destroy the Nephites, these are overly generalized accusations that justify the action taken against them. Mormon keeps telling us about the Church of Nehor. They love the vain things of the world. It says they pretended to preach according to their belief. I think it was more likely that they really were preaching according to their belief. Remember that we only have Mormon's word that they were pretending. We need to remain aware of our biases. That's one of the big lessons of this chapter, I think. So the Nehorites persecuted the members of the church. They afflicted them with all manner of words. Note that Alma accuses Nehor of enforcing priestcraft with the sword, but it seems that persuasion was their primary tool. Mormon says that they afflicted them because they were not proud in their own eyes. They didn't impart the word of God one with another without money, without price. Or perhaps other reasons, like they thought investing in religion or failing to live life fully is a waste of time. They probably preached a form of hedonism, the idea that we need to live this life as fully as possible. So there's a law that there shouldn't be any persecution. Verse 22, they began to be proud, began to contend warmly with their adversaries, even unto blows. Yea, they would smite one another with their fists. I always thought that wording was amusing. Again, this sounds like duels. The Nehorites caused much trial in the church. The hearts of many were hardened. Many withdrew themselves from them. Here's some personal application. Why do people leave the church? Why do people disagree with us? This is a vital question, and I think it's one of the most important ones to discuss in this lesson. One complication is that we can't understand someone else's perspective, especially one that overlaps or challenges our own, without being changed in the process. What I mean by overlapping is if we are making different claims about the same relationship or the same person or the same institution, it becomes a zero-sum game. We can't both be right. And social science shows us that we most often argue to prove ourselves right, to confirm that we are right. This is confirmation bias. And we rarely argue or debate to find out what's right. That's a developed skill. Verse 25, this was a great trial to those that did stand fast in the faith. Nevertheless, they were steadfast and immovable in keeping the commandments of God, and they bore with patience the persecution which was heaped upon them. Mormon is invested in contrasting members of the church and the Nehorites, but even so, the members of the church really do set a wonderful example. They all diligently labor, they are all equal, everyone works, every man according to his strength. So again, Mormon is putting these in juxtaposition. They did impart of their substance. They did not wear costly apparel. They were neat and comely. That is modesty, you know, not being ostentatious. Verse 28, and thus they did establish the affairs of the church, and thus they began to have continual peace again, notwithstanding all their persecutions. Here's a provocative question. Could the church even have been better off for having been challenged by the unbelievers? Often opposition gives us a chance to grow and define ourselves. And the Niharites, with their challenge, could have reaffirmed and strengthened the members of the church in their values. Here's an important insight, verse 29. Because of the steadiness of the church, they began to be exceedingly rich. Here's some good life and financial advice. Steadiness, the ability to apply effort consistently over time, proves more valuable than brilliance or other gifts. They also lived within their means rather than seeking extravagance. Note the focus on clothing in the Book of Mormon, which was often a primary sign of wealth and antiquity. And verse 30, this is important. In their prosperous circumstances, they did not send any away who were in need, and they kept working. This is the ideal that God wants. Everyone has what they need. The people of God not only have their needs met, they're even prosperous, they're rich. But here is the key. That prosperity does not prevent them from continuing to, one, work hard, and two, help those in need. I think this is the ideal. Now, the problem is, because of human nature, it's not necessarily sustainable. People tip over into pride easily. But if we were able to keep this point, I think it'd be pretty perfect. You know, people work really, really hard. They gain the rewards of that hard work. They live comfortable lives, but they also help those in need and they keep working. The Niharites, on the other hand, indulged themselves. They were wasteful, and so they could never have enough. There was peace at the end of Alma 1, but not a sustainable peace. In Alma 2, we meet the next villain of this narrative. Nehor is dead, and now we have Amlici. We learn that he is cunning, he is a wise man as to the wisdom of the world. This is a common theme with those who oppose the church or priesthood leadership. It's quite plausible that Amlici was a Mulekite. That hypothesis makes the rest of the narrative make more sense. The Nephite heirs left a vacuum, then the Nephites switched the government around to shut out the Mulekites. But then the Mulekites took matters into their own hands. It's very important to note that first they try democracy. Amlici is voted, or they try at least. Mormon says, were it possible that Amlici should gain the voice of the people, he being a wicked man, would deprive them of their rights and privileges of the church, for it was his intent to destroy the church of God. I don't know that I'm persuaded by this intent to destroy the Church of God motivation that's being thrown around all the time. I think he threatened the Nephite hegemony. The people vote for or against Amlici, having much dispute and wonderful contentions one with another. Sounds familiar this election year. They assembled themselves to cast in their voices concerning the matter as laid before the judges. So the people voted against Amlici, but we don't know, what is he talking about, the Nephites versus the Mulekites? But the people who were in favor of Amlici, they gathered together, they consecrated Amlici their king. When Amlici was made their king, he commanded them that they should take arms against their brethren. Thus he did that he might subject them to him. Again, he may have felt justified in being a king. There could have been a lot of frustration. Verse 11, now the people of Amlici were distinguished by the name Amlici being called Amlicites, and the remainder were called Nephites, or the people of God. In other words, those who are on the right side. Could there have been another resolution to this conflict? They did begin with voting, remember. But it becomes a war. The most interesting thing about this war is it's different than other battles in the Book of Mormon. One of the meta themes of the Book of Mormon is that when the Nephites defend themselves, God supports them. But when they go on to the offensive, God does not support them. Offensive, proactive battles are seen as bad. And if you read carefully, it seems on both sides, actually, that this is a battle of annihilation. Note that the Nephites pursue the Amlicites. I mean, the battles get really, really bad. Like, it wipes out most of the people. But they're not just fighting to resolve a dispute. They're trying to kill everyone. Alma gets points here. Not only is he a religious and a government leader, he's a military leader. You know, what can't he do? Verse 18, the Lord did strengthen the hands of the Nephites. They slew the Amlicites with great slaughter that they began to flee before them. Note how many ways Mormon makes the point that the Nephites are on the right side, backed by God. Yeah, perhaps they were, but we can still highlight Mormon's rhetoric and assumptions. And this is where it gets tricky. The Nephites did pursue the Amlicites all that day. Why couldn't they just let the Amlicites run away? Why did they have to pursue them and wipe them out? You know, isn't there another resolution? Think about, just as a modern parallel, the Israel-Palestinian conflict. I mean, there are other ways of resolving this than wiping them out. Verse 20, when Alma could pursue the Amlicites no longer, he caused that his people should pitch their tents in the Valley of Gideon, the valley being called after that Gideon who was slain by the hand of the sword. And Alma sent spies to follow the remnant of the Amlicites. So they've already wiped most of them out, that he might know of their plans and plots, that he might guard himself against them, that he might preserve his people from being destroyed. Mormon is laying on the justification quite thick, but doesn't it sound like Alma is working to wipe the Amlicites completely out? Whatever led to it, things get really dangerous in chapter 2 because the Amlicites join up with the Lamanites and they march on the Nephites, and the Nephites can only run away. This likely happened, again, because the Nephites were trying to wipe the Amlicites out. We can't know the exact details of everything that happened, but it's really useful to look more deeply and see what's going on. And again, challenge and be challenged by the scriptures, realize that there's more going on than just the surface narrative. We have a war story. Alma is fighting with Amlici face to face. Alma and his guards then fight with the king of the Lamanites. The king of the Lamanites flees. Alma and his guards kill all of their guards. They're throwing bodies into the river so they can have room to cross. I mean, that gives you an idea of the extent of the battle. The Amlicites again flee. I mean, they're numerous, but they flee. Verse 36, they fled before the Nephites toward the wilderness, which is west and north, away beyond the borders of the land. They're out of the land. The Nephites did pursue them with their might and did slay them. They were met on every hand. They were slain. They were driven. They were scattered. The Amlicites were indeed dangerous, but I'm intrigued. Again, this seems like a philosophy of annihilation on the part of the Nephites. Verse 38, it came to pass that many died in the wilderness of their wounds and were devoured by the beasts and the vultures of the air, and their bones have been found and have been heaped up on the earth. As opposed to the times when even the enemies were buried, this sounds like it was an example similar to crucifixion to dissuade the Mulekites from rebellion. The Nephites weren't just trying to protect themselves, they were trying to send a message. Okay. Whatever the reasons and the details behind this war, things are really grim in the beginning of Alma 3. It came to pass the Nephites, who were not slain by the weapons of war, after having buried those who had been slain, they weren't numbered. They were finished burying their dead. The wording suggests that only a minority survived. This was an exceptionally costly battle. Verse 2. Many women and children had been slain by the sword, and also many of their flocks and their herds. Many of their fields of grain were destroyed, for they were trodden down by the hosts of men. Both sides were trying not only to win, but to annihilate. Killing flocks and herds and women and children and trampling grain, this is an attack against the very society. It's not just trying to win or trying to be a leader, they targeted and destroyed their ability to survive. Mormon then goes on this tangent about the Lamanites being cursed and the Amlicites marking their forehead. Now, a red mark on the forehead is not the same thing as the Lamanites being dark, but this is rationalization for Nephite endogamy, for only marrying within the group, and possibly for Nephite elitism. Mormon is saying, you know, the Lamanites are the enemies and the Amlicites are the enemies. They're all grouped together. The Nephites are just. The Nephites are holy. Basically, the Nephites deserve the leadership. Verse 18, now the Amlicites knew not that they were fulfilling the words of God when they began to mark themselves on their foreheads. Nevertheless, they had come out in open rebellion against God. Therefore, it was expedient that the curse should fall upon them. Again, this reading has made me thoughtful, and I doubt that Mormon is a reliable narrator. There's something fishy about this battle, and Mormon's points don't line up. The details don't actually support what he's talking about. He shifts from the Amlicites being a danger to the Amlicites being cursed by God, to the Amlicites rebelling against God, when primarily, it seems, they were setting up a king. And so Mormon is justifying this battle of annihilation. But then the Lamanites come and attack them again. This is a really difficult time for the Nephites. I would suspect that the Lamanites were trying to use this opportunity to wipe out the Nephites, since they had experienced such devastating losses. Alma is afflicted with a wound, probably from his battle with Amlici. Verse 26, in 1 year were thousands and tens of thousands of souls sent to the eternal world that they might reap the rewards according to their works. Whether they were good or whether they were bad, to reap eternal happiness or eternal misery according to the spirit which they listed to obey, whether it be a good spirit or a bad one. Every man receiveth the wages of him whom he listeth to obey. This according to the words of the spirit of prophecy, let it be according to the truth. The wars were such a tragedy that Mormon can only make it sound better by emphasizing the afterlife. Okay, so we have the Nehorites, we have the Amlicites, we have this battle that nearly wiped out the Nephites. And this is where we are at the beginning of Alma 4. The people are greatly afflicted for the loss of their brethren, the loss of their flocks and their herds, the loss of their fields of grain. So many people were killed and resources were destroyed that it threatened the functioning of society. And what happened, it awakens them to a remembrance of their duty. Difficult moments put life in perspective, and they can wake us up to what's most important. They begin to establish the church more fully, people are baptized, but it doesn't end up well because the church begins to be proud. Alma and the leaders are extremely grieved for the wickedness, and the members of the church become more wicked than those who are not in the church. They begin to be scornful. They persecute those that don't believe as they believe. Scorn or contempt is the single most destructive emotion that we can have for another human being. Even hate can engage someone, but contempt demeans them. Verse 9, thus in this 8th year of the reign of the judges, there began to be great contentions among the people of the church. There began to be envying, strife, malice, persecutions, pride, even to exceed the pride of those that did not belong to the church of God. This is fascinating and sobering. The church becomes a vehicle not for redemption, but for damnation as it fosters pride. It seems clear that church is actually increasing rather than checking the pride and wickedness of its members. And so in summary, the church began to fail in its progress. The example of the church began to lead those who were unbelievers on from one piece of iniquity to another. This is really, really important. And it helps us to remember that the members of the church can be wrong. The members of the church can be bad examples. It's natural for us as humans to think in simple terms, to assume that we and those like us are right and on the right side. But we have a moment of honesty by Mormon where he says, no, you know, the members of the church, they were the ones who were causing the problem. Then Mormon talks about inequality. The Book of Mormon teaches that failing to care for those in need or becoming wealthy at the expense of others are both serious sins. The minority were abasing themselves, succoring those who stood in need of succor, imparting their substance to the poor, feeding the hungry, and then thus retaining remission of their sins. Look carefully at the bad example versus good example, and this is the same formula as King Benjamin's sermon. By caring for others, we retain a remission of our sins. In other words, we live within a saved or redeemed state as we care for others. The wording of verse 15 suggests that the majority were sinful. Verse 16, and Alma selected a wise man who is among the elders of the church, gave him power according to the voice of the people. It's interesting, Alma chooses a man, almost certainly his brother, since we're told in Alma 50, and not until Alma 50, when Nephiha dies, that he turned down the records from Alma. And this top-down decision is then ratified by the people. Mormon fails to mention that Nephiha was Alma's brother, probably in order to make it sound more democratic. Note that even though the Nephites have a voting system, the leadership suspiciously passes down Alma's dynasty. Alma retains the office of a high priest, and he goes forth among the people or among the people of Nephi. This is another admission of the deep divisions among the people. And he wants to preach the word of God among them, stir them up to remembrance of their duty, pull down by the word of God the pride and craftiness and the contentions, and reclaim them through pure testimony. And he confines himself wholly to the high priesthood of the holy order of God. So these are complex chapters, lots of conflict, lots of war, lots of death. And if we read really closely, we hear a story or uncover a story of prejudice and even genocide. And as we read about Alma's mission in the next few lessons, we will learn that it is a very mixed experience. And in fact, it leads to one of the worst times of Alma's life. So life is really complex. And we gain the most benefit when we read and listen carefully, when we question ourselves. And it is to such points that we will now turn to in the lesson. I first want to ask the question, how can we constructively learn from the story of Nehor? It's really easy to do the normal thing and treat Nehor as bad and Alma as good and confirm our biases. But ironically, I think that is the opposite of the way that we can use this story, the potential it has. And I think the place to start is to ask ourselves, how can we be aware of our biases? How can we be aware when we are assuming someone else is wrong and we are right? I think the first step is to be aware, to take very seriously the fact that we are often wrong. If we think we're right and someone else is wrong, they likely think the same thing, that they are right and we are wrong. If we take seriously and internalize that being convinced we're right and craving, feeling right, that this is part of human nature, we can move beyond it. So one, be aware of our biases and then be humble and open and teachable. If someone tells you that you are doing something hurtful or that you're incorrect, listen to it. Sit with it. You know, is there any truth to this? Do I need to do anything? So others can be a good tool, a good resource for learning where we're wrong. Those close to us often have an idea of where we're wrong. And it needs to be expressed in a safe way. Perhaps have one time a week when you talk about difficult things. We can also be self-reflective. We can look at interactions and say, how did I do? You know, did I live up to my ideals or did I fall short? The next step, you know, realizing we're wrong, is we can respect others who believe differently than we do. You know, we don't really have a good example since Alma wiped out Nehor and executed him. I really like a quote by Elder Renland. that he shared. He said, "We can stand firm in our beliefs and have a loving relationship with those who hold differing opinions. For example, I believe drinking alcohol is a violation of God's law. So what do I do when I'm hosting friends who do not believe as I do? My wife and I arrange to go to a restaurant with them where they can order as they choose to, and when they order wine with their meal, I do not get in their faces and call them out as sinners. Similarly, can I be friends with individuals who are living together without the benefit of marriage? Absolutely. And when I am with them, do I stand up in great indignation and call them to repentance, even though they are presently engaged in behavior I do not agree with? No, of course not. We can stand firm in our beliefs and have a loving relationship with those who hold differing opinions. Let us not forget that the plan of salvation offers the love and mercy of our Savior Jesus Christ to all." Ah, such good stuff. And helpful when we are dealing with this anti-Christ or oppositional paradigm. So I'm suggesting that this story of Nehor in a way describes what not to do and can serve as a productive launching point for discussion. As another good example, I wanted to share a letter that a friend's parents wrote him when he told them that he had left the church. These are his words. "From Mom, I am proud of you for doing this. I respect you as a person and I respect your decision. I will never let you go no matter what. I love you. I think getting this out in the open is actually a really good idea for you. It will make everything more comfortable for you and you won't feel like you have to go through the motions for anyone or put on a show. Everyone has to find their own way. That's what life is all about. We talk a lot about the gospel, but what we really need to care about is the truth. The truth is that each person has to find themselves and progress in whatever way they can. You are a man and you have made your own decision. How could I think to take that from you? From Pop. I was here for you before you were even born, and I'll be here for you when you exit your mortal coil. Nothing can ever change that. My greatest sadness has been that you were unhappy and I cannot fix that. If this contributes to helping fix that problem, then so be it. I love you. My friend. I explained to each of them that I've joined a support group, that unfortunately positive responses like theirs are rare, and the exceptions to the rule. I gave some examples of hurtful things from family and friends have said to people like us. Hear their responses to that. Mom. Well, those people obviously don't understand a thing about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Christ is love. He never shunned anyone. He never said an unkind word, and he certainly never demonized or berated them for making informed decisions. Pop. That's absurd. My feelings for you are like the ocean beneath a ship, vast and constant. You will always be my son, and I'll always love you. Besides, the first two commandments are to love God and your neighbor. How can you fulfill that by disowning or demeaning your children?" Can you just feel how amazing that response is? I don't know why everyone can't respond that way. What I appreciate is that my friend's parents did not change their beliefs. They did not back down from their testimonies and belief that the church is true, that the gospel is important in the plan of salvation. They just applied it in a way that also allowed them to respect their son. So here are the steps: respect, love, understand. So love means caring, showing consideration, showing a willingness to extend yourself for the benefit of others. And it's a commandment to love. Like, love is about us. Love is about our relationship with God. Love is about the way that we are supposed to be, the kinds of people that we are supposed to be. The next step is respect. Respect is more difficult than love because you can love someone and not treat them very well, because it can be a ill-informed love, or we can have other issues that are preventing us from showing love in an effective way. But if we show respect, this means, I think, giving the person a benefit of the doubt, remembering that person's character, seeing the good. Like my friend's parents said, "You're a man. You made a decision. I trust it's an informed decision. I don't want you to be unhappy. If this is making you happy, I'm grateful for that." The hardest step, and one that will not happen in all cases, is understanding. This is a form of conversion. This is allowing the other person to influence you, seeing their side of the situation, seeing where they're coming from. And it stems from respect, because if you think that your loved one doesn't make decisions for dumb reasons. The easy thing to do, the too easy thing to do, the natural human response is to vilify people that disagree with you. Say, oh, well, you're just dumb or bad, or you want to sin, or the devil has a hold of you, or just dismissing that person, making them less, objectifying them so that you can feel better, so that you do not need to be challenged by their difference. But if you respect someone, I mean, you can respect someone and agree to disagree. That's fine. That's a good starting point. But I do believe that the most courageous thing to do is to consider the possibility that they might be right, that they might be right at least in some ways, or even if not that, that they may have something to teach you. And this is where conversion happens, where you respect someone, you say, you have influenced me. The wonderful thing is that this makes difference of opinion a win-win. If we can say to someone, I still have my opinions, but I respect you and I'm opening myself up to you, and I see where you're coming from, even if we don't change our opinions, we feel validated and valued and seen. It's worth returning to Daniel Dennett's Guide for Constructive Disagreement, because I think this is so good. I've shared this before, but here are the steps. How to compose a successful critical commentary. 1, you should attempt to re-express your target's position so clearly, vividly, and fairly that your target says, thanks, I wish I'd thought of putting it that way. 2, you should list any points of agreement, especially if they are not matters of general or widespread agreement. 3, you should mention anything you've learned from your target. 4, only then are you permitted to say so much as a word of rebuttal or criticism. So instead of saying, like, you're wrong and I don't need to listen to you, which unfortunately is the model presented with Nehor, imagine if Alma said, so Nehor, what I'm hearing from you is that you think church is a waste of resources and we should enjoy our lives here, and that everyone should be saved, or, you know, whatever Nehor's argument was. And Alma could build on that. Alma could say, yes, you know, I agree that the Savior is the way to redeem everyone, and that those who are without the law are redeemed, and that I have learned from you that maybe we can take this life for granted. As an aside, I think a really productive thought exercise is asking yourself the question, if, for the sake of argument, you knew that your existence would end at death, would you still live your life as you are now living it? If the answer is great, that's fantastic. You should feel really good about the way that you're living. And then finally, Alma could say, but, you know, you killed Gideon and there needs to be a consequence for that. Or let's talk about the Amalekites for a moment, and whether or not they're Mulekites, the same situation could pertain. What if Alma and the other judges said, I understand that you're frustrated because you feel shut out of the political process, and how can we resolve this constructively? I think that such an approach could have saved a great number of lives and avoided this absolutely devastating battle and loss. So in summary, how can we constructively learn from the story of Nehor? Kind of use this as a bad example, frankly, you know, not excusing Nehor from anything he did, but being aware that there's more going on than we first notice. We need to be aware of our biases. We can ask ourselves, how can we respect others who believe differently than we do? How can we communicate effectively across ideological divides? Jonathan Haidt is just amazing on this. He talks about team psychology and how we assume that we're right and how we can respect those that believe differently. And I suggested the steps: love, respect, and understanding, each of those being more challenging. So the important keys that we can apply to our own lives. Okay, what was the Church of Nehor? We have a very skewed perspective on this, but from what we can piece together, as I said, it seems that the Church of Nehor was a mixture of a Christian universalism. I don't know about Christian. They never mention Christ, but the word saved indicates some sort of paradigm, or it could have been a form of religious humanism, probably focused on hedonism, enjoying this life fully, likely believe that religion misdirected emphasis and resources. And I think there's some valid critiques, and the church could have become better by listening to those critiques. We'll come back to these ideas in part three. Another point we could talk about productively from this reading is the contrast between the two churches. What did the true church do? The true church were humble, shared, they worked hard, they cared for each other. They were prosperous when they didn't allow that prosperity to prevent them from working hard, helping others, you know, maintaining that tension. And their response to opposition was that they became more humble, more patient, and more caring. In contrast to that, the prideful people, you know, the Nehorites, as they're described, were wasteful. They were indulgent. They were distracted. They were selfish. Another point that we can talk about that's very important from this reading is how to be a responsible citizen. Again, very timely with the presidential election coming up. But one of the most important points is that it always matters. It's always important to engage. And this is a problem that we have as citizens, is that when there is something flashy, like a 4-year presidential cycle, we get all worked up and excited, and we're so excited to vote for president. But we forget the fact that politics is something that happens every day, that laws and bills and proposals get passed every day, that government is happening continually. You know, it's not just something that we care about every 4 years. And being a productive citizen means engaging with the political process on a consistent basis, not just getting excited about the circus every 4 years. And I freely acknowledge that this is an area that I could do better. I talked with my friend Benjamin Knoll, and he suggested a few resources to help us know where we stand and be informed on the issues. I will read these, and I've also included these in the attached lesson notes, so please do go look at those. uselections.voxe.org, isidewith.com, that's an easy one to remember, ballotpedia.org, and finally, votesmart.org. Remember, votesmart.org. Get informed about the candidates' positions, what's going on, so you can make an informed vote. And then, of course, getting involved in the community is the ideal and what we all should be doing. But at least we can participate in democracy and vote in an informed way. And it's really tragic. Too few vote, and then far too few vote in a thoughtful, informed way. So that's what we need to be aiming for. I mean, again, all of us should be talking to our politicians and making our communities better, but, you know, not likely to happen, unfortunately. Finally, depending on your Sunday school, you could talk about this hidden story of the Amlicites if you are persuaded by the way I presented it in the reading. I think it really adds up on a close reading that the Amlicites voted. You know, they voted for a king, and the Nephites annihilated them for it. It doesn't seem like there was much tolerance for challenging the status quo. And so, yes, the Amalekites presented a very grave danger, and especially when they combined with the Lamanites, but they were fleeing for their lives. So again, this can be an exercise in looking at things from a different perspective. I have a firm testimony of human limitations. It's something I take very seriously. And this is an important element in humility, I think, is that we need to be aware not only that we are flawed, but the ways that we are flawed, the mistakes that we will fall into again and again because we are human. And a part of the gospel is remaining aware of those, remaining humble, and seeking to overcome that human nature and becoming our best selves. Okay, moving now to part three, the study notes. As I said, a close reading suggests that Nehor was preaching something like either a universalism, and I've attached a chapter by Dan Vogel about universalism in the time of Joseph Smith, and a humanism, you know, that everyone should prosper and enjoy life. Now, I want to talk a bit about humanism and religion and how too often both sides engage in a caricature of the other. So the religious caricature of humanism, and this is what Alma was accusing Nehor of, is that humanists make humans their gods, that humanism is a form of idolatry, that humanism shows a lack of humility, that humans are their own saviors. I see where the religious people are coming from with these critiques, but I think that it can be there can be a both and solution, because yes, that can be a tendency of humanists, and in a sense that is true. But the both and solution is that Mormonism has a very strong humanist element. Mormonism teaches that we humans are gods in embryo, that we are not different than God, that we will become God. We are taught that it is our responsibility to build up Zion, that we need to redeem each other, that we need to be angels and saviors to each other, that we are God's hands. There are so many empowering messages within Mormonism that allow for humanists and members of the church or religious people in general to have a productive conversation. So what is the humanist caricature? The humanist caricature of religion, and very likely Nehor was guilty of this, is that religion is a complete waste of time and it should be absolutely annihilated, and it's stupid and foolish, and that religious people are dumb. But again, I think humanists, it's interesting that Nehor established a church, which would make this a sort of religious humanism, unless he was just trying to compete. Humanism takes human nature seriously, and an aspect of human nature is that we humans are religious. And so that also creates common ground. Now, why do people leave the church? Now, building on this mention that a lot of people did leave the church because of Nehor. Well, let's talk about what's going on today, because right now, a lot of people are leaving the LDS church. Now, it's very easy to do what Alma did to Nehor and say, you are wrong, you are leading people astray, I need to destroy you. But that's not productive. I mean, we need to understand where people are coming from. In February 2014, John DeLynn released the results of a survey where he asked people why they left the church. Whatever you think of John DeLynn, he certainly talks to a lot of people who have left the church. And I think that he has done a great deal of good. And part of that is that he is helping have these conversations about why people leave, why people stay, and to help people not feel alone. So let's respect these people who have left the church and listen to their own answers about why they left. Why Mormons Leave provides several important resources that summarize the findings of this survey. So I'm going to go through some points in a comprehensive list of reasons why people leave or stop believing the LDS Church. One, they were never converted. They were never really converted or integrated. This is the largest group. So think about converts that were never really active or people who go inactive almost immediately. Now, that's different than lifelong members who leave the church. So here are some more people have problems with foundational scriptures, historicity problems with the Bible. Only a small amount of people had scientific issues. People have problems with the Book of Mormon, Book of Abraham, Joseph's translation. There are historical reasons dealing with Joseph Smith, treasure digging, folk magic, multiple first vision accounts, Joseph's character. I just looked at something on grantpalmer.com that gave historical evidence that in addition to Joseph's polygamy and polyandry, you know, marrying married women, the most disturbing aspect of Joseph's sexuality, that's a very high bar, is that he believed in spiritual concubines, which was basically that he felt he had the right to have sex with any woman he wanted. This is what he called spiritual marriage, kind of like marriage for a night, and that he commanded them not to tell. Like, this is not okay. I mean, I believe that Joseph Smith was inspired. I have respect for what he did, but this is really, really disturbing. So again, there's polygamy, masonry, succession crisis. People come to believe that science is a more credible way of knowing than religion. There are theological reasons, you know, not believing in the theology of Mormonism anymore. The problem of, you know, suffering in the world, doctrinal reasons, you know, that there's no clear standard for Mormon doctrine, loss of belief in the one true church concept, issues around the doctrine of eternal families, the teaching that God curses people based on race, losing belief in the ordinances, the proclamation to the family, and then social reasons to leave the church, issues with the church's position on race and women and LGBT issues, and then cultural reasons, the way the church functions like a cult. I mean, I think that the church is a conditional cult strength religion. By that, I mean that if you fit in the box, you can be really happy in Mormonism, that there are a lot of rewards in being an active member of the church. But if you don't fit in the box, all of these cult-level elements just slam into you. And so a big reason why people leave the church is because they're miserable in it, because it is not a good fit for them. So again, you can look at whymormonsleave.com for some of those resources. But no matter where you are, listen to people. Listen to loved ones. And if you have a boundary that you don't want to talk about why someone has left the church, that's fine. I think we should know ourselves and our limits and our resources. But love them. Don't shun them. Don't dismiss them. And on their side, I think it is their responsibility. You know, how can those who have left constructively talk to active members? I do not believe that people who have left the church should actively try to proselyte and destroy people's testimony in the church. I focus on well-being. I'll share something really quick that touched me. In the Facebook group, people were commenting that the Sunday School podcast is a useful resource both for those who want to stay in the church and those who have left the church. That's my whole goal. My goal in this podcast is to create an approach to Sunday School that is beneficial no matter where you are on the spectrum. And I think that's one reason why it has been so successful, is because I am not aiming at keeping people in the church. I am not aiming at trying to make people leave the church. I am aimed at well-being. Where do you experience the most well-being? Do you experience the most well-being in the church? Great. Let me help make church better. Do you experience the most well-being leaving the church? Okay. I want to help with that process too. Can we sometimes be strengthened and better for being in a difficult place, for remaining in the church, even though it's hard? Sure. I mean, I really think that is the case. Wherever you are, I want to make that a better place. That's my goal. So in summary, I think an important starting point is that we take seriously the fact that people do things for reasons. People can defend their actions, usually. And it's not because they're stupid or bad or misled. I mean, sometimes those are elements. We have limitations, but we can have compassion for those. So we can respect people and say, you know, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to assume that what you're doing, you have valid reasons for. Let's talk about them. So how do we constructively talk to someone who has left the church? I'm going to summarize a Rational Faith's post, what to say to a friend who's leaving the church. First, what not to say. Are you reading your scriptures or draw a line in the sand? You know, it's all about this. If you won't obey this commandment, why, you know, or is either the church is 100% true or a complete lie? You know, don't make lines like that. Don't tell them, just choose to believe, or be careful where you're getting your information, or stop thinking about those issues. Just focus on the core gospel truths. Or, but you had a spiritual experience. You think God didn't know about those issues when he gave you that spiritual experience? Okay, so these are things to say. Wow, that must have been a very difficult decision to make. What can you do to help? Want to catch a movie this weekend? In other words, just be their friend. Tell me about it. Have people in your ward been giving you a hard time about it? So what's next? You know, I don't agree with the way you said that, but I think I understand what you're getting at. You're saying. So these are just suggestions. You know, people differ, of course, but here's the summary or the conclusion. You know your friend, focus on your friendship, send a message that you care about your friend as a person just as much as you cared about them as a Mormon. And I think this is especially important because Mormon culture teaches us that there is no other valid way to live than as a temple recommend holding fully active member of the church. And that's just not true. There are so many ways to be a good person, and so we need to engage each other as people rather than members and non-members. Okay, finally, is there an ideal form of government? That is beyond my depth. I have linked to some resources. It is important to realize that all government is a compromise between freedom and structure and stability. And so the ideal government is one that allows people to have a degree of freedom and voice, but also takes care of them and has enough structure that it encourages their best impulses rather than their base impulses. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Engaging Gospel Doctrine. I am excited to get this out by midday on Saturday. You know, I'll keep pushing ahead, get a buffer as I finish up. Please, please, please continue to support the podcast. Don't bail as soon as it's over. I'm going to keep working on it. I'm going to keep it pertinent, and I need your support. It makes the biggest difference to see donations and subscriptions coming in as I work very hard on this podcast instead of seeing notifications that they are canceled. I understand circumstances change. But stick with me. We're going to be doing a lot of wonderful, worthwhile things. So let's keep working together, and please know that your support means a great deal to me.